This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. The interview today is with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Today's date is June 20th, 2006. This is side one of tape one. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning, Bob.
To begin the interview, if you would, for the record, tell us when and where you were born, a little bit about your parents and your early years of schooling.
Well, I was born right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Huh, you were?
The best place in the world. In my estimation. My parents were both in graduate school at the time, actually. And my father was in law school, and my mother was getting her almost PhD, which she never quite completed because I was born and she did her dissertation but never stayed to defend it.
And the date, Martha?
Was November 25th, 1949.
Okay.
And I was born in the old university hospital. And my dad recalls being across the street at the old bar, one of those bars, having a beer. And so being worried, you know.
Of course.
Yes. And so.
Well, it's classic, isn't it?
Classic.
Your mother is giving birth and your dad's having a beer.
Classic Wisconsin story because, of course, you know, fathers weren't allowed to be in the delivery room at that point.
Uh-huh.
So then he goes over, and I was born, but I had a long labor, so he went to have a beer. It's a great story. And so they had met he was from Racine, and my mother had grown up in Madison.
Oh.
And actually, my father's family originally was from Portland, Oregon, but they had a lot of family in Racine, but he had gone, my dad's father had gone into business in Saskatchewan. They had lived, he had been in the oil business, and he lost his fortune.
Huh.
In the Depression, they had no money, and so they had to go live with the relatives in Racine and kind of scratch a living out by hook or crook, odd jobs in Racine. And so my dad had to literally, you know, work his way through, and him and his three brothers, and they all had to help, you know, support the family along with the parents in the Depression, as one of those stories, you know.
Indeed.
And then they all made their way to the university, working their way through. So we have the stories of Dad working in the train yards and that kind of story from that family. And then you have my mother's story of being reared in a very intellectual family of my grandparents. My grandfather was a faculty member here in chemical engineering and one of the founders of the profession of chemical engineering, a very distinguished family.
And his name, Martha?
Olaf Haugen. Mm-hmm. And Olga was his wife. And he, of course, has an oral history on in the archives as well. And I'm very proud to also have my oral history done in that tradition.
Indeed.
And he was very active in the emeritus faculty group as well to encourage the oral history program when it initially started.
Mm-hmm.
But that background was very interesting for the two of them, and they got married, you know, her from a very stable background, even though the faculty, of course, during the Depression had to go for a few years without salary raises. They did have very stable jobs.
Yes.
And they met here, and
as undergraduates.
In graduate school.
In graduate school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And my mother had an econ undergrad, and my dad had poli-sci, and then he was in law school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in law school, and my mother was getting her PhD at the time when they met. in the old Kennedy Manor bar on Langdon and Wisconsin Avenue. A friend from Racine introduced them. Peg Dew. Yeah, Margaret Dew. A very generous donor to the foundation, by the way.
That's good, Martha.
A very, yes. And a very interesting woman. But Peg Dew, by the way, married a man who was from Italy, and she moved to Rome, and he was the librarian for the Vatican. So, again, a story of our Wisconsin alumni who have done wonderful things, you know.
Wow.
But, so they stayed in touch over the years. But wonderful, you know, Wisconsin roots. And then, so I was born, and they lived in this little apartment on the third floor in on Hamilton Street, of a little triangular apartment. And they had to walk three flights up, you know, with the groceries and this baby and so on. And then they took turns taking care of me while they were doing classes. And, of course, I hear stories about this. I had heard stories about this. But then, of course, they had my grandparents' house to go to.
And where did your grandparents live?
At 2247 Raleigh Avenue, up here, on the other side of West High.
Mm-hmm.
And they built that house in 1923, 1 year after my mother was born. And my grandfather designed it, so it was, you know, engineering. It was very properly laid out and everything. And it was the end of the streetcar line at that time.
Huh.
And, you know, that was the end of town was the Forest Hill Cemetery. And, of course, that was where the, you know, the Confederate graveyard was.
And yes.
So on. And so even though Grandfather was a engineering professor, he was always very interested in history. And so I got very early tours of the gravestones and tours of the cemetery early on, and tours of Dane County churches, and tour, you know, that side from him very early on from history. And my father was very interested in history, and my mother was very interested in history. And of course, eventually, I'm jumping ahead, but that's why I majored in history eventually. Can't escape it, but very interested in history always. So.
Your roots are very, very deep in Wisconsin, are
yes.
they not, Martha?
Yes.
Really?
And then my grandmother, Berg, my married to Olaf Haugen, she was actually the one who was kind of the closest immigrant to Norway. It was her mother that who came to Norway at the age, came from Norway at the age of 19.
Oh.
And it was my grandfather's father was actually came over from Norway when he was just a tiny infant, you know. But the other one was a little bit more. She had actually come over herself, and, you know, been the one to say, "I'm coming over." And,
is she the one who was probably most responsible for your awareness of your Norwegian heritage?
No, I don't think so. I think it was my grandfather. I mean, except, well, it's hard to say because, it's difficult to say because it was really the Berg. The Bergs we had more connection with because they were closer. They were had a closer connection because they weren't so many far generations removed.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had Bergs coming over from Norway still.
Oh, you did?
And one of them, Oyvind, in particular, he lived with us because, of course, Norwegians were very poor until after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one, Oyvind, who lived with my grandparents after the war. And he was there the year that I was about one, and because my parents were here getting their degrees, and of course, so he saw me when I was a little baby. But those couple years when I was a baby and Oyvind were here were particularly happy ones for the family, and it was my great-grandmother Berg always lived with my grandparents. So it was a very difficult thing, you know, in those days. She never wanted to give up her Norwegian citizenship. It was difficult. And of course, we, you know, it was a strain, but some of us say, well, that was why my grandfather was so good at research, because he used to escape to the lab, you know, sometimes. And the other thing is, of course, because there was this extra woman in the house, they would entertain, you know, all the graduate students, the foreign graduate students in particular, but and we make this joke with one, Jim Mathias from Texas. He was considered a foreigner.
Yes.
He always says, he jokes. But, you know, Thanksgiving or other, they always, and even Sundays, you know, they'd always have these, you know, lots of people over for dinner, you mm-hmm. know, because they just had that extra hand around to cook all mm-hmm. the time. And so there was kind of this gathering Sunday. So, of course, I, later when I came to school here, I got into that habit too with them. But when I was a baby, there was just this Haugen, you know, every Sunday, and this whole family gathering, and mm-hmm. with this great grandmother from Norway who was a great cook, and you know, put on these gatherings, and you know, then I was kind of smothered by all these people. I can imagine.
Well, it's wonderful,
yeah,
but
it does
explain some of the depth of your emotional commitment to the university and Wisconsin.
It was tremendous.
Martha. I mean, many of us are aware of that about you, but I think to have this detailed like this, it adds some better understanding of really the depth of your personal commitment here, which is a factor in your career,
It's a factor, jumping ahead, right. It's a very much a factor, but the other part of it is, too, is very interesting. To me, it is, and reflecting on these issues, is as with any giant of when you have such a giant and a genius in your family as Olaf Haugen mm-hmm. was, it's kind of difficult living under his shadow as a child, mm-hmm. but not as a grandchild.
No.
And so for me, it was great. And, you know, but as a child, it was never difficult for my mother, I think, because she was a girl. Mm. But the pressure was on, but it never bothered her, I think. I mean, she never got a B in her life. I think she got one B in college. And that was like a stain on her.
Scarlet letter,
in German,
huh?
Yeah, in German. She always told me. Yeah. She, you know, got all A's in high school, and she got all A's in college except for one B. And because, I mean, the standards were like, this is what you do. Mm-hmm. And so, and in a way, I think, but it was just an accepted thing, and this was an organized thing. And so, but yet she had a good social life. She was in a sorority, and she had a lot, very close friends in Madison from way back kindergarten, and an extremely unusual group of friends that she has continued to stay in touch with. But being an only child and an only girl with a very male-dominated field of engineering, in a way it kind of took the pressure off of her in a way, because it was engineering, you know, so she wasn't kind of expected to go into that field. But was she expected to marry an engineer or all this, you know? So there is all this expectation. So it was very interesting that she really chose a man who was very much totally unlike an engineer and very funny and a liberal politically. And it was very interesting. So and yet wonderful and a very gentle man, very gentle man that had a very good personality that fit with my grandfather, who was a very gentle man as well, and kind man as well. Mm-hmm. So I always had in my life, you know, both my father and my grandfather, very kind men,
uh-huh.
and that's what I was used to being. How I was used to being treated by men. very kindly.
And were you taken seriously?
Oh, yes.
As a girl?
Oh, tremendously. Oh, yes.
And which also must have stood you in good stead later on.
Oh, tremendously, yes, by these men. And my mother, of course, you know, almost PhD and all this, and, you know, very much.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectual was very important. But I think to go on about, you know, then why did we leave Wisconsin, I think is the question to me when you say why our roots are deep, but why did we leave Wisconsin? And I think part of the reason was because of the shadow, the Haugen, you know, was so big, is that I think my mother always felt, well, first of all, being a lawyer coming out of Wisconsin right after the war, there were no jobs. There were very few jobs. Yes, he could have started his own practice and so on. But she always felt he only would have been Olaf Haugen's son-in-law.
Huh.
You know, it was that big. And she, you know, and plus my mother had a hankering for travel. Because her parents had been traveling all over the world and also all over the country. Every single summer, my grandfather always had a teaching job at a wonderful university. Like she went, they were in New York, and they were in California, and they were at all these wonderful universities and everything. And she had always lived in Madison, and so she wanted to live in other places. So that was part of it too. So it was both, you know, the opportunity to live other places and then no really jobs and then just the feeling of we want to be our own people. I mean, she, and my mother, more. I think, a dad, I think, would have done whatever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he was just kind of an easygoing guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he was happy. But I think he was happy. He loved Wisconsin. He would have stayed. But, of course, he wanted his own career. But then we moved to Washington, D.C. And, of course, for me, my background then went on where we did move to several different places where we lived in Washington, D.C. for 4 years because he had a very, very good career in the government in the Internal Revenue Service as being an attorney.
Oh.
And, of course, it was, you know, the time when government service was really the highest service and that we were really in the idea of, you know, ask not what you can do for your country. And so, you know, but it's the Kennedy idea of doing something for your country.
And how old were you when you moved to Washington?
Well, I was like 2 years old.
Oh, you? Oh,
3 years
this,
old.
You were just little.
Yeah.
When they left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was little. So then my brother was born in Washington, D.C., but I remember Washington, D.C., and, of course, what did we do at Washington, D.C.? To make friends. We looked up Wisconsin alumni. I mean, all the friends from Madison. So Tashi Toki, you know, the Toki farm out here, the Toki school now.
Mm-hmm.
And this was our best friend. And, of course, we made other friends. But it was always the Wisconsin people that were our friends in these places. And so Tashi, I just saw her. She was in Madison 3 weeks ago. I mean, she's always been a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then but I've always had that. Then we moved to Minneapolis. So I went through up to grades three in Minneapolis. And then my second sibling was born, my second brother. And because my dad went to that regional office.
With the IRS.
With IRS. And then, because with IRS you're transferred around. Because, mm-hmm. of course, the national office is D.C. And then he got offered another promotion. Then my brother had asthma and we thought that would be helpful to go to Los Angeles. And so we moved to Los Angeles. That was hard because it was, you know, we moving away from the parents and everything, mm-hmm. the grandparents. But Minneapolis was great and a very interesting environment, good schools. But California still had good schools when I grew up out there. But, of course, that was a very you know, huge, I don't know, impact on my life, the California experience. Okay. And I think that, you know, the Minneapolis experience was more like a Madison. Mm-hmm. In that you have the Midwestern values and so on. The University of Minnesota, very similar to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But then going to California, where you're exposed to all these different cultures and values, and then on top of it, you've got, pretty soon you have the 60s and the Vietnam War and the drug scene, and mm-hmm. you have all this coming in, coming at you. And I think, again, my parents, who were their friends, well, when we moved there, these friends of ours, who my mom's best friend from kindergarten and from Randall School, was Marion McCammon. And her sister, Jean Lovell, had married a student of Paul Naplin, who was the famous history professor at the UW. And Colin Lovell was the student's name, the graduate student, who was a very prominent professor of history at USC. And so Colin and Jean Lovell lived on Hillcrest Drive in Los Angeles. And so my dad had flown out and to see them, and he saw this house for sale up the street from them. And so he called my mom and he said, "There's this house for sale," and he described it. And my mom said, "Buy it." So they bought the house up the street from the Lovells, and they had a daughter my age, Nikki. And so it was wonderful because we had these Midwestern friends, and we also had this other family named the Caldwells, who were also from the Midwest, and he was also a professor at USC. And we're about, I'd say, 20 minutes from USC. And so, you see, again, it goes back to these old Wisconsin roots. So, and then Marion lived nearby, and they, Jean Lovell and Marion, grew up on Regent Street, about three doors down from, the grocery store down there on the corner of Regent and
Allen,
thank you. Regent and Allen, yes. So here they were, and they grew up about a block and a half apart. So here, you know, here I was. I grew up a block, on the same block as Nikki, in Los Angeles. So it was very
So nice. You were in L.A. proper.
L.A. proper, West L.A.
Wow.
Yeah, it was called Windsor Hills, Baldwin Hills area. And so we went to the grammar school, Nikki and I, and Nikki had an older brother, John, Jock we called him. It's just nice to have another family, even though Nikki and I were really good friends when we were younger, and then when we got older, you know, sometimes we, you know, it's like any teenagers, we drifted in and out. But now, who did I go visit when I was in L.A. in the spring? Nikki, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, she's really the only friend that I've really kept. You know,
yeah.
From anybody from high school.
How wonderful,
of course.
Actually.
It's just great. Yeah. And her son actually went to UW Whitewater, at any rate. So it's just, yeah, it's great. And she married a wonderful guy, and a Jewish man, just wonderful guy. So I enjoyed that, but it was always nice to have that connection. But again, it shows that Wisconsin roots, even though wherever we were, and then all their friends seemed to have people either with Michigan degrees or Illinois or whatever, even though they were transplants out in California. So this, you know, later on it's like telling me something is here about these Midwest values, you know. And there were a few people from California that they were friends with. But of course, there are a lot of people from the Midwest out of California. But I had a nice group of friends Campfire Girls, wonderful group of girls, and Maggie Van Prague probably was my closest friend at that time, and Nikki was in that group, and a bunch of other girls. But then something really that was, I'd say, kind of tragic happened, and that was some very greedy and evil people started to spread racist hatred around Los Angeles and in our area. And they spread fear, and the realtors would start knocking on your doors and say, "Black people are moving into your neighborhood. You think you should sell?" And when I was in the sixth grade, there was one black girl, Luana, and she came to my sixth grade birthday party. She was the daughter of the janitor at our school. But then the African American people, we were kind of up on a hill, and you could see Watts, and you could see you could see it from our house down there. And in the valley, or not in the valley, but off the hill there. And you could see that, you know, what happened is that African-American families were doing better financially, and so they were coming up. They were buying the better houses. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of in the, like, up half of the hill. On the other really good area, you know, people like some of the big baseball players and some of the, you know, Ike and Tina Turner lived. And, you know, some wealthy African-American entertainers, baseball players and stuff were buying these houses. And so this was kind of rocking the neighborhood. And so, and what was the worst thing about it was, you see, that these people, and especially the real estate agents, were trying to make a buck on this. Mm-hmm. And they were having a feeding frenzy by spreading racial hatred. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'll always be grateful to my parents for standing up to them, but it was a very stressful thing for us as kids. And we often talk about it now. You know, and my mother says, of course, my dad died 20 years ago, but, you know, should we have done that? Should we have stood so long? You know, because by the time I graduated from high school, I was one in a 5% minority.
Really?
Uh-huh.
The neighborhood changed that much?
That fast. From sixth grade, I was one. There was one black person, janitor's daughter, who had to drive her in. And so, in other words, what happened to me, all my friends left. Okay, and so my Campfire Girl friends, what they did is Kitty moved down to Palo Alto. And I stayed in touch with Kitty, and I hear about her like Nikki stays. Nikki and I were the only ones that graduated.
Oh, Nikki stayed, too.
Nikki stayed. And that's because we're tough Wisconsinites, and we were liberal, and we stood up, you know, Nikki stayed. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I didn't know this about you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Marion Brown knows it about me.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. But I don't talk that much about it.
So this would have been, like, in the mid-60s?
Yeah, because I graduated in 67.
Oh, just before the Watts riots. Then.
Yeah. What year did I graduate? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I think that's a little-known story.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. And Martha, as you think back on it, the role of your parents and then your own experience of being a minority in right. in a black majority, which is a very unusual phenomena, mm-hmm. particularly for a middle class, upper middle mm-hmm. class white girl like yourself. What's been the long range impact of that on you?
Well, I've often thought about it, but I've just always felt like I could go anywhere and do anything. It's been a very empowering thing, you know, somebody did write a book about this, though, you know, about being one of the whites in the 5% minority. Mm-hmm. There was white like me or something. I forget the name of it, but mm-hmm. I did see, and I haven't read it because I lived it, you know, but I need to read it and see what this woman said. But Marion and I, Marion is an African-American woman who I hired, and I'm going to tell that story a little later because I love that story. It's a great story.
And for the record, Marion Brown is?
Vice President of the UW Foundation, colleague who I hired at the UW Foundation.
I didn't know that.
Yes, sir. And she went to my high school in L.A.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
This is side two of tape one of the ongoing interview with Martha Taylor. Martha.
Well, let's see, I was talking about California some more.
And high school. And
high school.
And finishing as a very small minority at a time in a high school when the demographic shift was mm-hmm. so dramatic.
It was huge. And my graduating class was 75% African American. And the reason we know this is we counted them in the class picture and we confirmed it with the high school. But Nikki and I sat down and counted them. And then 20% Asian American and 5% white. And of course, a lot of those white people were Jewish.
Oh.
Yeah. That was interesting.
Huh.
Yeah. But what's of course interesting about that is you look at that and you say, where are the Hispanics today? And there really weren't any in that particular neighborhood. We did not have Hispanics. I think that is really interesting. It was really, what was happening there at that particular time was, it was the rise of the African American socioeconomically, mm-hmm. which I applaud, and moving into the better neighborhoods, and so going into our area. And when you look at it, really, there was some problems in our high school. I think they affected our my brothers a little bit insofar as, you know, fights and things like that. But, you know, there were not any problems any different than what we have in our schools today. I mean, in fact, I think our schools today with gangs have a worse time. I think gangs have become worse today than then. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the rules about high school were stricter then.
Yes.
And about coming in and out of the buildings and that kind of stuff. Although there were problems, there's no doubt about it. There were problems. But the other thing is that, you know, it's the same as today, is if you were a good student, you were in the good student classes,
mm-hmm.
and you came and go as you wanted to. The other part of it was there was really no interracial dating, which is weird. I mean, even, you know, they, like, the black guys would flirt with you, but there was not any interracial dating. they didn't ask you out, and you just didn't do it at that time, because we never even thought about it. I mean, there were families like the people next door that, you know, he was white and she was black, but, you know, it just, it wasn't a common thing as today. And I think it's so much better today because, of course, then what happened, I was a very tall white girl in my school and there was like two guys that I could date. And so I ended up dating like college boys and like, you know, who I met through other friends and stuff, but in junior college boys. But I mean, there was nobody really to go out with. Or like my friend Kitty, who lived in Palo Alto, she'd have me down for parties down there. But that was awkward, you know. So you knew them as friends, but that was a strange thing, you know. So I was in athletics, and that was fun. And that's where, in swimming. And Gwen...
Oh, you were a swimmer.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was captain of the girls' swim team. Yeah. I wish there had been more athletics. I would have been more. It was fun. It was a great way. And I think that's where I got to really meet a lot of the other African-American girls and, you know, get to be friends. But I was really... good friends with a lot of different races, and of course a lot of the Asian girls were friends, and we had a good time.
That too has stood you in good stead, has it not?
Oh yeah, and the guys too. I mean, in the gym, the dances. You know, I mean, it's not like you could go to a dance, you know, a school dance, and you dance with all the black guys. You could do that. It's just you wouldn't be going steady with them or something. But the dances were great. And both my brother and I, Bill, who's 2 years younger than me, I mean, we know how to dance. I mean, I don't know how to dance anymore, probably. But we did know how to dance. I mean, really dance. Yeah. Bill and I did. Because they really did have good dances. And, you know, and like my husband Gary says, you know, we have these wonderful African-American friends here, and there was this little girl dancing the other day, and I was going, yeah, she knows how to dance. You know, really teaching her. He says, you're being discriminatory. I said, honey, no, it's just something, you know, they work on, like you teach somebody, like, to throw a baseball. This is something... that in the African American culture, it's something you work on and you teach them the steps. And it's really a wonderful expression. It's like an art form, like you teach somebody like painting. You know, it's a wonderful thing. And my next door neighbors, I used to go over there and they used to play. It was play, like they put the music on and you'd have the kids dance around. And it was just a fun thing to do and have them dance, you know. I mean, it was a great use of time, you know.
Absolutely.
Cheap, too. I mean, so, you know, these different cultural things. I mean, I learned about, and so what does it do for me? It makes me comfortable in these different environments. And so it has done me well. And when I come here and then I can speak to different backgrounds, and also I was in a position later on when I was at the foundation in a very crucial position to push for funding for the Chancellor's Minority Scholarship Program.
Actually, Martha, would you talk? I know this is a little bit out of sync. But there's a logical, emotional connection here. So you might talk about the Chancellor's Minority Scholarship Program.
Sure. Well, I'm doing it out of sync, but it was, you know, I think coming here was, that's another story, but the reason the foundation, I think, was viewed, and as many institutions at Wisconsin, is not having any connections or understanding about minority issues. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I do not think it had any sympathy on these issues mm-hmm. at that time, mm-hmm. or understanding, because of lack of any experience mm-hmm. with any minorities, mm-hmm. period, zippo, zero mm-hmm. exposure to any minorities. Mm-hmm. No knowledge, or even other than maybe friendships with minority athletes mm-hmm. is the exception. And that's wonderful, and you can't discount that. Mm-hmm. But looking at the fundamental question of should society invest money in minorities because they have been disadvantaged? Mm-hmm. Okay. That was the issue on the table at the time mm-hmm. at the foundation and for the foundation board. And Mercy Lee was pushing to get the Chancellor's Scholarship Program going from the university. And it was mid-80s. I'm trying to remember the year. I was trying to remember the year when mm-hmm. I was writing up last night what I could get it. But, and Bob Rennebaum asked me to work with her. I mean, he knew I'd grown up in Los Angeles. And Steve Myra from the Student Financial Aid Office was the other person. He's very sympathetic to this. And also Joe Curry was involved.
Oh.
Joe is a wonderful man, wonderful person. Mm-hmm. And I have the utmost respect for Joe. Always have. And the many things I've worked with Joe, one of my favorite people at the university.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I worked with him with Arts Outreach and on many things. I mean, if I was ever in trouble on anything, I'd call Joe. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's that solid on anything. I mean, anything. I just really respect Joe. And so Joe has given, by the way, a scholarship for a disadvantaged person.
Oh, has he?
Yeah.
Oh, good for Joe.
Joe and Barbara together. But, so what happened, the politics of it were, I think part of it was corporate America kind of hadn't bought into this, and the idea of people giving money to this kind of thing mm-hmm. just had not been accepted. Mm-hmm. So Marcille called this group together, and she was absolutely the driving force, and I knew what kind of conservative minds I was dealing with at the foundation, and yet I was very sympathetic to this. You know, emotionally, and I knew why it was needed.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Because of the experience I had had. And also, you know, I mean, I didn't paint everything out rosy. I mean, maybe I painted things too rosy. I mean, the problems that I saw for the African-American families, that they needed, you know, scholarship help. They need help just like any family whose children have never been to college. Mm-hmm. It's like families I see, you know, out in Prairie du Chien, whose, you know, the economic basis, that they just don't know the options available to them, and they have no way of knowing how to wind themselves through the system of getting to college. Mm-hmm. But the minorities need it more. And especially at that time. So, Marcille called this committee together, and we met. And so we came up with this plan, and we went and we presented it to Irv, and basically it had this foundation element to it. Of it was a half-time position, half-time reporting to Marcille, and then half-time reporting to me, and basically it was for 3 years, and we had to, it was to raise money for the Chancellor Scholars and then to administer it. It was Marion Brown's position.
Oh.
And you know, I had spent a lot of time working on it. At that time, I don't know, I forget how many. I had several staff people reporting to me. But I really had a good relationship with the board of directors of the foundation. And they really respected me and liked me mm-hmm. personally. And they had no idea about my background. And they also, you know, knew me kind of as this purebred Wisconsin girl
uh-huh.
image. Mm-hmm. They had no idea about anything of this Los Angeles thing.
Hmm.
Which, in fact,
most
people don't. And why do they need to? Other than if they ask me, I'll tell them, or, you know. But sometimes it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And I try, when I try not to get angry, or sometimes it comes out. But, so, because it's more useful that way if I don't.
Correct.
It's more useful.
Yes.
And
of course it is.
And Marion and I have agreed that it's more useful if I don't say anything. Because
mm-hmm.
then I can really be an advocate, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Just behind the scenes. It's much more powerful.
Indeed.
Because with her, being African American, it's obvious her stance on this. But with me going around,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's different. You know. Okay. So, I went in there. And Irv was convinced.
Irv Shane.
Oh, and of course, right. Irv Shane is wonderful. And I'll talk about him later. And his vision and I'll talk more about Irv later. But on this particular issue, we convinced Irv to do this. And he saw the need. And he said, yes, we should really do this. This mm-hmm. is very important. And of course, that's what we needed. And he was willing to go to the board of the foundation and ask for this half-time position. And of course, he had to say it's important for the university because the foundation can only do what the university wants. And then, of course, when Irv said it was important, then Bob Renabon said, well, then, of course, if Irv thinks it's important, the foundation will do this. He said, I think it's going to be tough, but I'm behind it if everyone else is behind it. Very important. For Bob to do that.
Absolutely.
And that was a big step for Bob. But he would do things like that. He would take risky things for the right cause. And I really credit him for that.
Were you influential with Bob Renabon on that?
Yes, I was.
Okay. I'm sure you were, but I want that for the record.
I was.
He talked about it.
Yes, well, at that, I was really, you know, I was very close to Bob. And I look at it and I think, what role did I have with Bob at that time? And I never knew because I was so oblivious. I didn't have an MBA or whatever. And since then, I've kind of looked at it. I was really his chief of staff is kind of what the role I took.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was kind of the role. So anything that was going on except for an investment, I kind of was talking to him about
mm-hmm.
all the time and knew what was going on. And so we would talk with each other. And he liked that because it was a lonely job, you know.
Yeah.
And I was non-threatening to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I was very supportive and we'd talk things over. So, yeah, and I said, we can do this, Bob. You know, well, it's going to be risky. Well, I know we can do it. Okay. So, but there were corporations in particular we thought that we can try. And
mm-hmm.
So we went into the interviews and, let me skip back though. The presentation at the board meeting, Bob was still worried about the board because we had to get the approval from the board for this position. Because it was controversial.
Mm-hmm.
You see, normally you don't have to go to the board of directors to get approval for a position, do you?
No.
You just put this in the budget, right?
Correct.
Note that. So I think this was the only position in the history of the foundation that we really had to go to the board to get approval of. And also, it was a split position, too. It was split halftime between the chancellor's office and the foundation. But it was because it was, you know, this minority issue. And I was the one that had to make the presentation.
Oh, you were.
It wasn't Irv. Wasn't Bob. The person they picked to make the presentation was me. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting.
Isn't that interesting that they picked me to do it? Mm-hmm. That Irv and Bob thought I should do it. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that a telling thing? And also, I felt very comfortable in doing that. But also, I think that they kind of felt, well, you know. And in hindsight, at the time, I thought, well, wow, this is a lot of responsibility. You know, but now I think, oh, that's nice, you know, because this nice young woman and the board members all liked me and thought I was doing a good job and I'm enthusiastic and, you know, Martha's going to work really hard on this and, mm-hmm. and, you know, gee, she's intent and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, an old group of men, they'd think, oh, this is nice, Pat. This kind of thing. But, I mean, that kind of idea. They took themselves out of the politics, you know, Irv and Bob. And instead it was, or maybe they put me up for the slaughter, but I don't think so. It was more like they thought I was a better person to do it. Isn't that interesting? I've always thought about that.
And you don't think it was because they thought there was a chance it might be turned down? And they didn't they didn't want that on their shoulders.
It could be. And yes, I did. And I've thought about that, too. Mm. I've thought about that they didn't want it on their shoulders. But also they thought, you know, that I might have a better chance of getting through. Because I had gotten so many big budget items through the board mm-hmm. that were controversial. Like, I'd gotten... like, I was used to making big budget item presentations. I'd gotten the constituency program through. Mm-hmm. I had gotten started the university relations grant, which was a kind of a whole new concept. And that was like making a whole new big chunk of money transferred to the university every year. The most controversial thing I'd ever gotten through already before this was the telefund. Now, that was the thing I got drilled on the most, because everybody, why is this telefund costing so much money? I mean, it's so funny, you know, on all the big expenses, but the telefund, that was the most difficult thing, I think, mm-hmm. we ever got through. So I think they were kind of used to me coming with big budget items. Well, here's another new program we're doing. So there was precedent for me doing that. But still, it's still this kind of, maybe Irv should have done it or whatever. But at any rate, I did it.
You did it.
And they asked me a lot of questions about it. And who's going to be the prospects and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And Irv did speak. Irv was present. Oh, yeah, Irv and Bob were present. And Irv spoke. I mean, Irv did speak about how important it was. And I think that was, you know, in response to question. Mm-hmm. He needed to do that. But it was approved, and I remember it was for $150,000 for a three-year program, you know, because we had to say it takes 3 years, and that was half of the budget. I remember that precisely, the amount of money. So then we got the go-ahead to hire someone. And so then we had a committee, including... It was the same group, Steve Myra, Joe Corey, and a couple other people, Marcia Lee, and me. And we hired people. I mean, interviewed people. And then Marion Brown came in. She was just looking for something else. She'd been teaching in the School of Human Ecology. And I looked at her resume when she came in. I was like, Los Angeles. She got her degree from UCLA. And her master's in design from UCLA, and she grew up in Los Angeles, and looking at this, you know, in the interview with all these people there. And I'm going, where did you go to high school? And she went, or I said, what part of LA did you grew up in. She said, Leimert Park. Now, I was up, like, on the little hill here, and Leimert Park is, like right at the bottom of the hill, like 2 miles away from my house, where I grew up. And so I said, where'd you go to high school? Dorsey High. And I said, I went to Dorsey High School. And she just about fell over. We went, yeah, my sister's Gwen. Oh, Gwen! Yeah, I was in GLA with Gwen. You know, it's like, and so everybody in the whole, you know, on the committee just fell over because it's just unbelievable. It's such a small world.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing was, you see, there was this huge, Marcia Lee didn't know this about me. I had never mentioned this to her. I mean, during all these meetings and everything,
right.
I'd never mentioned my background to her. Mm-hmm. Why did I need to? This was not an ego trip for me.
Right.
And in this blink of an eye, it was like, whoa! And so it was, all of a sudden was a wonderful thing for Marion to realize she had a friend at the foundation where she was going to be working that understood where she came from, understood the issues, and that was sympathetic to her issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bob, one of the happiest things in my whole career at the foundation has been the success of Marion Brown.
Oh, you bet.
I mean, really. So, you see, that goes back to the whole, my whole California experience. And
it really does, Martha. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to talk about it now, because there's such a natural connection.
Sure.
Between your growing up there in the hills of L.A. in the mid-60s and what you and Marion Brown and the foundation with Marcia Lee have done.
Sure.
While it's not enough.
It's not enough, but we work on it.
You started the aggressive effort to bring minority students to the UW.
Yeah. You do what you can, and then I think also, of course, then I got interested in women, you know, too. It led me to be more sympathetic to women as, I mean, also looking at those issues.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you did, you know, what, that's why it is interesting, I think, and when you do these oral history, to look at the experiences of people as they're growing up, because it does influence them, of course.
It forms them.
Yeah.
Martha. It really forms them.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're back in high school, and you're graduating.
I'm graduating, and now I'm wondering, what am I going to do? And also, it was a very unsettling time, of course, because of Vietnam.
Right.
Then Vietnam came. And, oh, my gosh. And then things were getting really unsettled around there in L.A. Oh, and then, of course, there were the Watts riots and all that. And then at the time, too, I was very active in our church, and we were trying to do things down in Watts and things like that with our church group, and, you know, doing all these, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I had applied here, and I was accepted at Wisconsin, but I thought, so far away and so cold, and you make all these random dumb decisions, you know, about going to school. But in a way, I'm just as glad I didn't come here as a freshman. But then again, maybe I'm not. Maybe I would have liked to have been here as a freshman. But I thought, so far away. I'm just going to go to Santa Barbara. It was just a random decision.
UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah. It's a smaller school, and it's close to L.A. I mean, I didn't know. You know, it's one of the things, I'll want to stay in touch, you know. But I didn't really have that many high school friends. I mean, it was just, I think it was more, I don't know. It's a nice place. It's pretty. It sounds nice, you know. Just a random decision. We've talked about this on kids making decisions on colleges. And I think it was more, Wisconsin is so far away. And it's cold. Because I kept deciding between them. And no, I'm going to go to Santa Barbara, and I can always transfer. So I went, which is, of course, what I did. But later. But I went to Santa Barbara, and I was miserably unhappy.
Oh.
it was beautiful and everything, and I loved it, and of course, I had a surfboard and all this stuff, and, you know, lived on the beach and did all this, but...
Why, you old hippie jock.
Yeah,
you.
I know, exactly. It was, but it was, you know, there were like 25 African Americans there, and I tried to make friends with them, and they were friends with me, they liked me, but it was like, who are you? You're a white girl. You know, it was like, so I had culture shock, reverse culture shock.
Huh.
Because I was used to hanging around in diverse groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all these rich white people, is what happened to me. That's what happened to me. And it wasn't so much the school, because I think the classes were good. And I had a religion class I really liked. I took film. I know I had a poli-sci class that I liked, but it was the kids. Because it was a school, you know, and I thought, what was this? And I think my mom had thought, because I was kind of a social kid and stuff, that I'd like the social environment. But we didn't think about the racial and that I would like the different cultures. And again, that makes me really sensitive to our issues of our kids going here, our minority scholarship program.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about that. Think of how sensitive I am to that.
You bet.
Our Chancellor's Minority Scholarship Program, we make a big deal about making sure the kids get together on a monthly basis with their cohorts. And, like, we have this posse program where you have 25 minority kids coming together to keep a posse. Hey, I know that firsthand because I was a white kid with a bunch of white kids in my same socioeconomic basis. And I felt like I was totally alone because I had grown up in a very, you know, mm-hmm. racially diverse group. Well, who would have thought that? You know, that was totally weird. And then, so I that was kind of a huge adjustment. And I never would have thought that.
No.
You know, because I was thinking, oh, gee, this will be nice. I'll finally have some white boys to go out with. And, you know... and plus, literally, and no, it wasn't. I was very unhappy there, very unhappy. And so, I decided. Although we had the second year, I had a roommate. We had a roommate from Berkeley, and I liked her. She was Jewish, and then I had an Asian roommate, another white girl, and me in an apartment. So
uh-huh.
we had, you know, that was a good. Apartment, and we lived across the street from the beach, so at least we had a little more interesting group. But still, by and large, the kids that went to that school, and also very wealthy kids. Aha!
This is tape 2, side 1 of the continuing oral history interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the UW Foundation, June 20th, 2006. So you're at UC Santa Barbara and you're encountering wealthy, great wealth and wealthy
yes.
students.
Yes. And so I think, I had experienced some well-to-do families when I was in Los Angeles. But when I really got introduced to them was at UC Santa Barbara, because mm-hmm. a lot of them sent their kids to Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go home to their houses, because I was friends with their kids. And
right.
Then, you know, I remember Kathy, and her family was from a small town in north of Napa, and Kathy Sullivan, and owned a company in a small town, and had a beautiful home, and you know, like, her family was the family in the town, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, it was a great and interesting time to meet them and really get to know the problems of these kids, and what they faced, and that the money, you know, didn't solve everything. I mean, it seemed like it was great to have the money, but there were other challenges with it. And then I remember Zach, and he had all the money in the world, and he had decided to kind of drop out of school for a while and just go sailing around the world. I mean, his dad had a boat, and he just decided to be a crew on the boat mm-hmm. for a year and go around the world. And there were different people. Then I dated this guy who had a Morgan, you know, one of those real fancy sport cars.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and his dad was a professor at UC Santa Cruz. And then he would go to the, the South Mexico, and he must have been an anthropologist because he'd go on these digs with his father, do research or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were traveling all over the place. And, you know, you'd have, then another one had a jet. You know, you had a lot of different stories like this. But a lot of wealth, and especially my freshman year, I got acquainted with them because for some reason there was a housing shortage, and because I hadn't made up my mind where I was going to go to school, I got in this private dorm instead of on campus. And so, you know, this was kind of where all the rich kids were.
Uh-huh.
And it was very different. So not only the cultural thing, but all these rich kids. So
did you like them, Martha, or did you dislike them?
Well, they were nice people. They were nice people, but it was, I mean, they weren't bad. It's just kind of like, they didn't seem like they were caring much about the world. And it was like, here I'd been in the midst of dealing with, you know, the issues of the world. I mean, we did kind of care about Vietnam, and we did uh-huh. get on that. And that's why, and eventually I did, you know, my roommates, I did eventually get for the next year, were more kind of political activists or uh-huh. something, but were interested in politics. But, you know, basically they went to school and had a good time and didn't seem like they were worried too much about anything or cared too much about anything. And that was kind of a shock from, you know, coming from a family who was very active in the, you know, Japanese American Democratic Party of South Central Los Angeles. Don't ask me why we were in it, but it was because that was the party right in our neighborhood, so.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we were always interested in things, and my mother was, you know, protested to get the oil well removed or not put in and across the street from the elementary school, and led that drive and successfully, and, you know, was chair of the PTA, and, you know, was very active as a volunteer leader, and, you mm-hmm. know, typical, kind of a typical Wisconsin progressive tradition back from, you know, my uncle here had been in the legislature, and my parents had always been active kind mm-hmm. of in the community and politically.
Mm-hmm.
And to go from that to people who weren't engaged. I mean, people in Madison, to me, are, even if we're not all active, we talk active. You know?
Yes.
I mean, we're engaged intellectually. I mean,
yes.
You know, in what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people are actually doing something or whatever. But so that was another shock for me culturally.
Yeah.
So, but it, of course, that really stood me well later on when I started working at the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew these rich families, and I knew them, and I was from an upper middle class family, professional family, but not from a family of great wealth, as mm-hmm. some of these other families I visited were. And been in their homes and knew the kids. And mm-hmm. But that was a good experience in that way. You know, you have to take out good experiences. And, you know, it shows you what you don't want to be. And also then that you get the decision of, yeah, there was some really nice young men, too, and really nice ones. You know, and sure, I could have married one of those nice young men. One of them, you know, his father had a big company, and he was a very sweet young man. But you know what? I don't know. He just didn't have the fire in the belly and interest in the world. But he is a very nice young man.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. So it's just time to leave that place. Just, I wanted to get out of there.
Uh-huh.
It just, there
That's
wasn't
very clear.
Enough intellectual stimulation. Of course, it's a very isolated place, mm-hmm. Isla Vista. It's away from Santa Barbara.
Oh.
And it's away from the town. And so that was another thing about it. But it's a beautiful place, just beautiful. And, of course, I had applied to Berkeley. And then
oh.
I was to transfer to Berkeley. This uh-huh. was at the beginning of the summer. This was after my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. I applied to transfer to Berkeley. And then my parents said, well, let's go for vacation to Wisconsin. This is like in August. Well, they were thinking. So the bottom line is, you know, because, of course, they knew I had applied here and thought about it. And, of course, I came here in August, and I had such a good time. Again, they said, well, just go see if you can. I said, you know, it'd be kind of fun if I just went to school here. Just left California.
Mm-hmm.
And we really talked about it. And, but I said, I don't know if I can take these winters. But I was just really ready for a change, and also intellectually I really was ready
mm-hmm.
for something more. And I went with my grandfather, of course, naturally they got me in as a special student. I mean, that wasn't going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just stayed here.
So that was 69. Would have
yeah.
been, right?
Mm-hmm.
August of 69.
Mm-hmm.
Not a quiet time on campus.
No, no. But it got worse at Santa Barbara, you know, because they burned the bank down at Santa Barbara.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
So some of the people I knew, burned the bank down. And, yes, and I knew them. And I knew who they were. And then, you know, then things got worse here. So Gary, my husband, was always joking about, well, Martha, you know, she went from Santa Barbara and then they burned the bank down there. And she, you know, well, but, you know, just because you know who the people are, you know. But I knew who they were on the campus. They were always running around and, you know, demonstrating. But I think it was just not a great time.
No, it was a hard time in the country
everywhere,
for everyone.
Everywhere. It was a hard time. But I think we questioned a lot. I mean, you were in school at that time, too. And we did question things, and we talked about things.
Mm-hmm.
We were engaged, you know.
So you enroll here in the fall of 69,
mm-hmm.
and you're here for, and do you go straight through and graduate then in
mm-hmm.
71?
Mm-hmm. I did. So
with
I actually
a major
in history.
Okay.
And then I went, my summer school, I went to Norway in 1970. And because I was really, of course, I was very interested in Norwegian things, and I'd always been interested in that,
mm-hmm.
Norwegian culture. And I took Norwegian when I studied here.
Oh, did you?
Because mm-hmm. I had wanted to do that. I'd always wanted to do that.
Martha, did you find at that time as a student that the UW-Madison was much more challenging than UC Santa Barbara?
No, I didn't.
Comparable?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I felt those, undergraduate, those freshman and sophomore classes are awful because there are big classes and mm-hmm. basic classes. And any time you took them, even when I took them here, I didn't. When you have any of those basic classes, what I really like were here were the smaller classes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you took more specialized classes instead of, I mean, not survey classes.
Mm-hmm.
So the classes I took at Santa Barbara that weren't survey classes, those I liked. Mm. Survey classes, I didn't like survey classes,
mm-hmm.
no matter where they were. I guess that was my
mm-hmm.
my experience. And I don't know why, but I just like looking at more detail, I guess. And but Wisconsin's history department, what I didn't take any history at Santa Barbara. I think at Santa Barbara I was taking mostly survey, except for the religion. I took a couple of religion classes. So maybe that's one of the other reasons I didn't like Santa Barbara, too. I was just taking these general survey classes.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really get into subject matter very much. Just so I fulfilled most of my like general requirements out there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came here, I got to take all the goodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to take the smaller classes with these great professors and really got to know the professors. You know, I got to go to the, be active in the Scandinavian department. And, I mean, I really took advantage of the university. Mm. And, I mean, I truly loved it. And I think the other thing is I really appreciated Wisconsin, you know, I don't think anybody could have appreciated Wisconsin more than me.
Hmm.
After what I've been through.
Absolutely.
And I get so emotional about it because it just, after being going through all that strife with the racial strife and then being in this with all these people in Santa Barbara, and it was kind of coming home for me.
Yeah.
You know, it was.
Clearly.
Yeah.
You really do. You really are Midwestern.
Yeah.
You are a Wisconsin girl.
I am.
In the best sense of the word.
I am. And the Midwest values here, I get choked up talking about it. But they're real.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Indeed they are.
Yeah.
Martha, let me ask you, as you think back on your 2 years at Madison, some of the memorable professors that stand out?
It was great. And, you know, and it's funny because, of course, usually I don't go into the detail about the Santa Barbara experience, of course, when I'm talking to donors and so on. I just say, I went to school here. I graduated in 71 because
mm-hmm.
when I'm talking to donors, the experience, what I talk to them about is them.
Of course.
You know, I don't talk, you know, I just want to say I went to school here too.
And, mm-hmm.
But I figure in those 2 years I got more out of my experience because I appreciated every minute so much, you know, and maybe everybody does, but I mean, I loved it so much. And also then, I was here for 2 more years in Madison working afterwards, and then of course spent my career here and heard all these professors, but I was just so ready intellectually for it. And because of the time, I think again I was really focusing on what did I want to do, and I was interested in two things, which is a contrast, which was I was interested in Norway, so I was interested in Europe, but Norway in particular because of my heritage,
mm-hmm.
and also the language. I really wanted to speak Norwegian and learn it and go to Norway because of these relatives I had. And then because of both my grandparents and my dad's interest in particular in Japan. And my grandfather had been in Japan, and my grandparents and my grandmother loved Japan. And we had all these relationships with Japan, and also because of the Vietnam War, I wanted to understand Southeast Asia more.
Mm.
And I was just interested in it as a culture, and I thought it would be interesting to know more about Southeast Asia and Asian culture. Mm-hmm. So I took a lot of history classes, and I decided to really have that to be my emphasis, is Southeast Asian history. So we happened to have, and it's funny, I always feel terrible that I never took a class from Michael Petrovich or George Mossi. Isn't that awful? It's just terrible. But I'd have all those requirements already at Santa Barbara, and I feel terrible. But I didn't know, you know, you're such a dingbat as an undergrad.
Well, exactly.
You know, you're so stupid.
We all are.
Yes. We all are. You know, but not some people. Like now, these undergrads, like my niece, she looks up every on the internet. Well, of course, you have the internet. You have things like, who has the highest teacher ratings? She looks at this every semester and decides who she's going to take. I mean, these kids nowadays, where were they? Maybe they didn't do this when we were in school. I think they did, but I don't know where these things were. Who knows?
But I have to think, Martha, that we got a better education in that it was a little more random, a little more risk-taking.
Oh, you're so optimistic.
Well, it wasn't quite as calculated. I mean,
was not calculated. You do have to say that.
I mean, I grant you, it's a tragedy that you did not get to hear George Mossi.
No.
On the other hand,
right,
you did sort of pursue what you thought you were interested in.
I did.
And there's value in that.
I did. And I heard them give speeches, but I never took a class from them. But at any rate, I always think, too bad. But I did have Eugene Boardman, and oh, what a wonderful man. Oh, he was wonderful. He was my major advisor, and couldn't have had a nicer person and a great professor mm-hmm. in the history department. And, you know, the classes also weren't huge, because
right.
it was, you know, Japanese history from the, you know, whatever eras, and a lot of Japanese I took, and then Chinese, and and then I took Vietnam. So Gene Boardman was a great professor, and of course he had written one of the major texts on Southeast Asian history. Hmm. And a wonderful man and a wonderful advisor as well. You could just always go to him, and again, not many numbers of people, so very accessible. And I think maybe in Mossi would have had more hordes around him mm-hmm. or something. So I really got a lot of personal attention. And when people talk about the big university, I got so much personal attention.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. And then I had in Scandinavian studies, Pat Joint was one of the teachers in Norwegian. She was from Norway. She was terrific. And Harold Ness was wonderful professor of Scandinavian studies. And lovely, lovely man. He had been, of course, a friend of my grandparents. And my grandparents had helped them kind of get settled in this country and, you know, had been friends. But Harold was one of the best professors, beloved in that department. Wonderful man. And I loved that department because they had, and still do, have very, intimate little Christmas parties, and people who just take classes, you know, come to their Christmas parties and come to their gatherings, and it makes the university very small.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really kind of an eye-opening experience to me, where you go to a Christmas party and, you know, the professors and the students are all drinking together, and, you know, you pass around the Viking horn and stuff like that. I mean, really Norwegian traditions. And, at Santa Barbara, you didn't do that kind of stuff. I mean, you have discussion sections. I mean, and maybe that's the kind of stuff you do as an undergrad. You know, as there's a real, you never see your professors outside of class in these big survey classes. But you start to do that in small departments, mm-hmm. or at small, like small liberal arts colleges. You start, you know, they have you over for dinner or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's what my grandfather always did in chemical engineering, you know,
yes.
where he had people over. That's what you start to do in graduate school, is you start to have that relationship, that personal relationship. And you start to see that a little bit then your junior and senior year, if your classes are small enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Scandinavian Studies, because the department is that small, they always did that for everyone. And so that's why I always tell people, if you're interested, you know, in this at all, here's a place to go at the university that will make it small. Or find another area of the university that is small like that, a department, that you can go to. You know, as I'm talking to donors now at the foundation who have children coming to the university, how to make a big university small.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really great way. So I really had a good time with the Scandinavian department, and I took a lot of, they had Scandinavian film, Scandinavian literature, and the Norwegian. And then I was taking history, and I took... Oh, Richard Valls, I've got to talk about him. He was great. I took a lot of classes from him. He was Dick Valls in film.
I don't know that name.
Yeah. Taught a lot of classes, Scandinavian Studies.
Hmm.
And he's still around. You might want to interview him. He was very, very good. Of course, Dick Ringler was around doing his peace studies. And in... you know, just real interesting things. And the Icelandic sagas, that was Dick Ringler. But since then, I've always kept up my interest in Scandinavian studies. And, you know, I've read all the, you know, the ancient, you know, history of the kings of Norway. And I've read...
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obscure things. I've read lots of novels. I've read literature. I've kept up on it. It's really one... interest I've really kept up on, because you can, it's manageable,
uh-huh.
you know, but I'm truly interested in it.
Do you think someday, Martha, you might do some scholarship in the area of Scandinavian study?
I don't think so, but one never knows. But it's certainly, I love it. I love the culture. I think the culture has something to offer the world. In terms of the attitudes of the culture to the world, the balance of the culture. That's why I guess I'm so intrigued with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my husband, Gary, keeps saying, you know, because I keep telling the boys, you should take Norwegian or something. He says, no, you know, you should take Arabic or something. But I want my boys to go to the international summer school as well as I did in 1970, and which was a wonderful experience with people from all over the world go to that. It's basically underwritten by the Norwegian government, so you don't have to pay tuition. You have to pay room and board and some tuition. But it's a great deal. I think my son went 2 years ago, and it was something like... It was very inexpensive. I mean, if I say the amount, it relative will be out of date, but it's mm-hmm. like $2,500. I mean, it was very inexpensive. And but the idea of it is to promote the Norwegian values, which have to do with... you know, balance of nature and harmony with nature, and also the message of peace, and which are very strong in Norwegian culture, individualism, but yet society, and of course it's a pretty much of a socialistic society, yet they stress the individual. So I'm very intrigued, as you can tell, going on and on about it, but I really do respect the culture very much, and I'm interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I continue with that, as I'm also interested, I like the Asian culture as well. So
mm-hmm.
I continue kind of those interests. And then I think those the other thing that I really studied at that time, and don't you love college because it's so wonderful, you can just study these things, mm-hmm. and subjects, that's what it's for, is art. I took art classes. I took a lot of art classes. I took...
studio or art history?
I took art history, But then I took studio classes on the seventh floor of the Humanities Building.
Oh, you did? You were up there, huh?
I was up there. I was drawing. I took a bunch of classes up there. And I liked them. It was great. And I'd also taken art at Santa Barbara, which they have a very good art department in Santa Barbara. I also took ceramics. So, I don't know, maybe I took 5 art classes, which is quite a lot. And, you know, it did, of course, it shows, again, I use that. I've always been interested in the art, as you are. And I've always had a sense of art going through elementary and high school. I've always liked art. But, of course, in my professional life, then, what I was able to do, I did use that when when I was responsible for the communications for the foundation. And I was responsible for developing the first corporate look for the foundation.
Oh, is that right?
Because it absolutely drove me nuts that we did not have a nice look for the foundation when I came there. That it drove me so nuts that it was not my responsibility. I'm one of these people that, well, when I came, there was just, you know, it was just so disorganized so far as a corporate look that I just volunteered to do it. And so that's another story. But because I just felt that was so important, that art graphic image, you know.
You are an original intellect, aren't you, Martha? It's interesting listening to you talk about this. You see things and you reach out for it, or to cope with it, or to modify it. I mean, you see things, you think about things, you see things, and then you do things.
Right. Yes. And
I think.
Right. Well, you know me, too. And I think I also was taught to do that, definitely by my parents and my grandfather in particular. And
yes, it is like an engineer, actually.
Yes, it is. It is. It's an engineer. And it's also like my both of my parents have that in them very much. In that if you see a problem in your community, like my mother with that PTA, you know, they're going to do something. You organize the community against the oil well, the community, or you do whatever. You don't just sit back. You are the person. It's your responsibility. I mean, a great sense of civic responsibility. In fact, almost too much in terms of my one brother. I mean, who has dedicated his life and practically lives in poverty to represent poor people as a lawyer.
Oh, that's right.
You
have
Bill.
Told me.
You know, and I talk about him with my sons, and they say he doesn't have the balance of looking out for yourself. And that you do have to look out for yourself as well, and your own family's taking money for yourself. And, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is a responsibility as part of society as well. You know, as you're launching your kids and trying to teach them about money and, you know, and their careers too. And what's the balance, the civic responsibility to society and doing things versus yourself? And, of course, versus some of these families in Santa Barbara, they're nice people, but it's like there's nothing wrong with them. But it's kind of like, what are you doing for others today? You know, and I think that's what bothered me so much. It's like they were so selfish, in my opinion, if I can be so bold as to say that. That really, to my values and to my Midwestern Madison, Wisconsin values, I questioned what are they doing? And I guess that's always been with my life is one of the purposes of my life is I always have felt and I questioned, how can you open the door to people like that? To show them the joy of giving to others, and that a lot of those people weren't very happy.
Martha, I was going to ask you if you felt that your experience at Santa Barbara planted the seed of what evolved into the most effective fundraising approach I ever heard, which was your talk about the joy. This is side two of tape two with Martha Taylor. Martha, we were talking just a little bit about some of your visceral reactions to the student body at UC Santa Barbara, and I was asking you about the evolution of your approach to fundraising, which has always, to me, seemed to embody the joy of giving. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's anything further you can observe about the evolution of that philosophy on your part.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess this is interesting to have it go back to Santa Barbara because I guess I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but of course it does very much, and because those students and many of my friends, you know, really had no, I mean, of course, I didn't know what I was going to do in my life either, but mm-hmm. their families, too, just didn't seem as grounded, a lot of them.
Oh.
And in comparison to the families I was familiar with in the, you know, these Midwestern families who, and the lively discussion about the politics and mm-hmm. the what was going on in the community and this kind of thing, what we were going to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that did sink into me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think that there's also a stereotype that can be made that you just think, which I know that some people have, that rich people don't, you know, care at all about anything that happens in the world, which is not true at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a matter of education. And so, that and of course, coming here and going to the foundation, and of course, me being mentored by Bob Brennabaum in the process of working with individuals in the slow process and not a sales process, but a relationship process. And a teaching process. And talking to people about the joy of giving. And yes, sometimes you talk about a campaign or something just to build up the timetable and momentum.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what Bob was always doing was building relationships. And I think a lot of people who didn't understand him or didn't understand the development process, just thought we were terribly slow. And some people still might think that about the UW Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But we just say, nope, that's the way you do it. Just look at the bottom line. And you just have to get out and talk to people. And I think my approach is maybe a little different in that I think you can do this educational process not only one-on-one, which is what we primarily do now.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a little bit in group sessions
mm-hmm.
in terms of we have faculty showcases where you bring out faculty and bring the message about what the university is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also have seminars on philanthropy to speed up the process of helping people discover the joy of giving or the process of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. Because I do think there is a process of whereby you can learn this joy of giving. I mean, I think there is an actual intellectual process that you go through. And that's, to me, one of the continuing stimulations of the field is, how do you teach this process? How do you help someone go through it, both one-on-one and as in a group? And their lives, where I'll spend the rest of my life, I guess.
Well, you know, as the rest of the record will show, you've been amazingly successful.
Yes.
That's just a fact, Martha. That's not a compliment.
No.
It's a fact. You have raised tens of millions of dollars.
Yes. But I really haven't raised it. I've helped people.
Of course.
To find what is their passion and how it relates to the university. Mm-hmm. And in also other cases, I've helped them find their passion and it relates to things other than the university as well.
Right.
And as long as the university is part of their philanthropic plan, it has been okay with the foundation that I talk to them about other things outside of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has happened with a lot of the families I work with and individuals is that they want my advice not only on their giving to the foundation but on their other philanthropies as well. And it's fine. As long as I'm representing the foundation and feel I'm not in a conflict of interest, I'm glad to do that for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pull out if I felt I was in conflict of interest. But working with an individual to move them away from viewing philanthropy as just an obligation or, and it may start there. So you got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, or like for some of these families, the rich, well-to-do families, where they feel like they have to do things, you know, for their business image or whatever. Maybe it has to start there. And then you start to move into, you know, I call that, I don't think that's really philanthropy, but they start to move into philanthropy where they really start to look at really their passion and really accomplishing something with their money and really seeing how their values are reflected in their giving. Mm-hmm. And really leveraging something to make a difference in the world. That's when they start to see real joy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they are really turned on. And, you know, you see their eyes light up and, you know, you really see a joyful giver, and that's real satisfaction.
Yes, and I bet you've seen a lot of that,
Oh,
Martha,
yeah, I have.
Because I don't think that you're particularly in it for the money.
Oh, no, I'm not. If I was, well, I probably would have moved from the foundation, but I also would have stayed on the management track of the foundation.
No, I meant not your personal money.
Oh.
You're not necessarily out there just to get the $10 or $100 million gift. I think you are there. You get those because you are interested in affording people the opportunity
to
be philanthropists.
Yes. Oh, yes. For me personally, I'm not in it for the money. Absolutely. Right. But I'm not in it to get the quick gift, is what you're saying.
That's right.
No, because if you never, it just doesn't work.
No, it
does not work. And I think The unfortunate part of the nonprofit sector is that with government funding changing so much, that the pressure on nonprofits is so difficult that so many nonprofits are forced into, you know, quick asks that that are forced, that that the pressure on people becomes difficult, and so that they really are torn and they don't have time to develop a good philanthropic plan. So that we as universities, we have the luxury, and it is a luxury, of taking the long-term view, because we've been in a business for many, many years, and we have the luxury of having somebody like Bob Renabom, who started the Plan Giving program, you know, 45 years ago, so that we have big bequests coming in to help fund our operations that we don't, not the bequests, but the float on the Plan Give gifts, and so that what it is, Bob, is, you know, we don't, that we hold a bequest for a year and take the income for a year, and then it goes to the department. But so that kind of money goes for our salary, so we don't have to worry about paying for our salary every year like small nonprofits. So we have the luxury of working with people on these big plans so that big money comes into the university, and then that keeps our overhead low, and but we also have the luxury of helping them with overall plans for all their philanthropies. So I feel that we represent them, and we represent the university, and we represent the nonprofits well, too.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's, that's why we have so many people, you know, staying for such a long time, you know.
Absolutely.
Doing the work.
Martha, so you graduate from the university in 1971.
71.
And when do you join the UW Foundation?
Well, not till 75.
Okay, so what happens in there?
Well, what happened is, in the meantime, in Wisconsin, I also had the fortunate luck of meeting a nice young man, Gary Antonowitz. And he was an from Waukesha, and he was kind of like my dad, and then he was working his way through college. But it was kind of a joke. My dad had always said, "Here, well, you've met all these minority groups, except for you haven't met any Polish Catholics, and you'll probably end up marrying somebody, some Polish Catholic from South Milwaukee." Well, I didn't end up, he wasn't from South Milwaukee, but he was from Waukesha.
Pretty close.
Pretty close. But that was one ethnic group I did not know. So, at that time, you know, everyone was, kind of, your family was not, it's not that important or whatever, you know, that kind of age. But to me, by that time, you see, it was, you know, because I had kind of been through this period of, you know, going to Santa Barbara and been away, and I knew how important family was, and also my grandparents were very important to me. And my grandfather in particular, respecting him and so on. And when I came here, it was really fun for him, of course,
to have
me here. You know, oh my gosh. So I went to, you know, so many things with him and my grandmother, and sometimes she was well and sometimes she wasn't. So I went with him to lots of stuff, the faculty and this was later, but the Princess of Norway came. This was at the museum, you know, and I got to go with him and sit, because of course he was, have the Medal of Honor from the King Olaf of Norway, you know, so he was the honored guest. Got to sit next to the princess and everything. So I got to go and all this. It was really fun.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, it was great being the granddaughter and, you know, and the Yggdrasil Literary Society and so on. But that was important to me. So, at any rate, so I met Gary. I saw him in the dorm. You know, I liked him at a couple of darn parties and went train down Miswater's Hills and saw him at a... Really, I talked to him for the first time at the bar across the street from the University Hospital where my dad had had the beer. Actually, we always talked about that. It was very funny. That was the first time I actually talked to Gary.
Is that right?
Yes.
You're not making this
up. I'm not making it up. It's very funny. It was actually the first time I actually talked to him because I'd see him at this party. And he starts talking about his grandfather up north in the cabin. I mean, up the farm up north. And he starts talking about him and the farm and the family and all this. And I said, oh, this is really nice. You know, a young man, I mean, a guy, a cute guy, who's talking about his family. Okay, this is good. Okay? So, I mean... Because nobody at that time, I mean, it was very uncool to talk about your, especially your grandfather. But to me, that was really important.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, and the farm and all that. And I had no exposure in all my background to anybody who had a farm. So, look at that. No exposure up to city, big cities and all. So this was very cool. Okay. And Polish, you know, and all this. Okay. So... This was very cool. So at any rate, went to the farm up north. I mean, they had sold the farm, but to the place across the street. Oh, this was wonderful, and all this vegetables and canning and all. Just exposed real Wisconsin. Just loved it. Progressive Wisconsin farm. You know, wonderful, wonderful man. Been in World War II and over in France and all this. So very interesting person. Not hadn't even been to high school, but very well educated, and that he'd been read all the time, and read the newspapers and everything. But interesting contrast between the two grandfathers, you know. But kind of held the whole community up there in Antigo, in that his farm during the Depression kind of he. Made it very well financially and hired just lots of different people and they lived on the farm and that kind of thing. So, but, so wonderful family. And so, at any rate, Gary and I decided to get married. And so, what also, I was deciding to go to graduate school because I knew I wanted to go to graduate school because I loved school. And I knew I had to get some practical application because I had this history liberal arts degree and I knew it. And my parents had always said, get your liberal arts degree and go to graduate school for some practical degree. I said, fine, okay. So, I had to get a job and then I thought I'd get my residency because I was paying out-of-state tuition.
Oh, yes. Right.
And that was another, you know, thing. And so I was going to get a job in Madison because Gary was here. Gary was younger, so he had time. He had two more years. Met a younger man. And so he, 1.5 years younger, but he was finishing his econ degree. And because I've been active in the church always, I saw this ad, Trinity Lutheran Church, church secretary. So I got hired as a church secretary. And then after 3 months, they hired another secretary, and they gave me youth as youth director, too, and gave me other duties because they saw that I could do a lot of other stuff and had all this other background in church work. And so that was a wonderful job for me. I worked at that for 2 years, and I established a historical library. Because of my history background. And one of the things that, and I got acquainted with Bob Gard that way.
Oh, that's where you met Bob Gard.
That's where I met Bob Gard. Because there was kind of this division in the congregation of, you know, the new pastor trying to change some things and the old members not feeling appreciated. And there was all these historical pictures in the closet, you know, and I said, what are these doing? And all this. So I thought, and all the old baptismal font and stuff. And I thought, is there some kind of room we could, you know, change this into, put these pictures on the wall? And, you know, I'd been through, you know, history classes and I'd historical society, blah, blah, blah. So they paid for me to go to some, you know, seminar on restoration of photos or something.
Oh.
So I went to the historical society. How fun this all is, and appreciation for our resources in Wisconsin. And, of course, then later on I knew how much money they needed and so on in my later life at the foundation. And so I got the youth group to paint the room, and we had a little opening, and we had the historical library at Trinity Lutheran Church, and then they moved it. It's really big now, and it's got, you know, it's got all these beautiful photos of the history of the church it used to be in a back room. Now it's like on the main corridor. And it's really a neat thing. And my grandfather really enjoyed that project too. We went around to all the Lutheran churches in Dane County and kind of took pictures and did this whole project. So it was really fun, you know, a fun project together.
Again, a seminal project that's left a lasting legacy.
Yeah.
Martha, something you started and it's still ongoing.
Yeah. Now that little piece, he wrote a couple of pieces and he presented those around to, you know, like churches and, you know, optimist clubs and stuff. And that was given, he gave it to somebody, you know, historical society gave it. It's called Chasing Steeples in Dane County. It's called.
Huh.
Yeah, because several historians wanted it.
Yeah.
Because we had gone around taking pictures, and it was like Howley Church and, you know, these different churches. And it was quite interesting to know all these histories. And it was a fun thing to do with my grandfather, of course. It was a wonderful thing for us to do. So we did that, and then I did stuff with the youth and that kind of thing. So, but then I also got involved with production of the newsletter, journalism. And then, ta-da, the stewardship drive. And the pastor, Carol Anderson, of course, is one of these people who had a great influence on my life, in that he had just come from chairing a campaign for the Lutheran colleges. So he was a fantastic fundraiser. And he really knew how to raise money in stewardship drives. And so here I learned this from him. And how to set up campaign, how to do a dinner, how to do a thing, how to do, you know, all this stuff, the canvassing, everything, you know, for a church. I mean, because that was one of the problems with Trinity, is the budget. And so he was really called, you know, that congregation for the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And the other pastor was Vern Oss, who I became very close to as an associate pastor and continued to be friends with. But Carol is the one who told me about the profession of development.
Huh.
Because who would have thunk at that time?
Yes.
No one would have thought that, you know, people were actually employed doing that. But of course, churches have been employing people forever to do that. And if you look at the history of, you know, philanthropy, those were the people who were employed. They used to employ people to canvass. They would go around on horseback from congregation to congregation and raise money. They would be great orators, and they would go and help the congregations raise funds for the individual congregations. But there's some wonderful stories that I have since read about these people and who they were and what they did and their characteristics. So that's where I originally got inspired for this profession. So Gary and I had decided to get married, and I was deciding because I thought, well, because of this church work and youth work and so on, should I go into social work? And then my dad was really encouraging me to go into law. So I took the law LSATs, and I did fine on them. But I was thinking, Gary had thought about law, and then I thought, well, I don't know if I really want to go to law school. And we thought about it. We talked about it. And then Gary was thinking of industrial relations. Mm. Because, you know, he had graduated from econ, but we have a good IR department. Mm-hmm. And actually, we were thinking of staying here, but then he wanted to get out of here. Because he had always lived in Wisconsin, and he just wanted to go someplace else after here working here. But I didn't blame him, you know, at all. But, of course, then we were kind of proud, and we didn't want to, of course, he didn't want to borrow any money. I'd never thought about that. And we were proud. We didn't want to borrow any money from our parents, and we just got married. So we wanted to go someplace where we didn't have to play an arm and a leg. Well, Cornell accepted us both, me in social work and him in industrial relations. But the price tag was really, really high. But, you know, I think of, well, Cornell, wow, that would have been really great in hindsight. But then West Virginia offered, I was accepted in journalism, and they had a program in philanthropy, development, and the journalism program.
No kidding. Uh-huh. Back then.
Back then. And then, and that was the other thing. I had applied at a couple J schools because of I'd written the newsletters. And, I mean, I was really, didn't know. And he got accepted in industrial relations because, he was interested in that. They had a lot of money, federal money, doing poverty research in West Virginia. And a couple of the professors were from Wisconsin because of the strong Wisconsin program. And the other thing is it was a lot cheaper, and we got offered, like, research work. I mean, you know, so our tuition was going to get waived.
Mm. Oh, significant.
So it was like, so we could really afford to go there. Mm-hmm. And so we went to West Virginia. And
where was the university?
Morgantown. And, of course, everybody says, well, you didn't go to Cornell versus West Virginia. Well, but Cornell was just a lot more expensive. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we were not your superstar students. You know, like I had a 3.2 or something. But, I mean, it was, so we got offered money at West Virginia, we didn't at Cornell. So, where are you going to go?
Right.
And so what it was is we were a big fish in a smaller pond. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas we weren't at Cornell. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a really nice experience for me. Of course, I've had a hard time being in that small town again. I learned that I liked bigger towns, just like with Santa Barbara, being in that really isolated place. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want to live in a place that's smaller than Madison. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in LA, I think I've learned that, you know, mm-hmm. that the town was too small. I used to have to drive up to Pittsburgh, you know, just to get my fix on towns.
Yes.
But it was, the people were lovely, and then we continued our campus ministry. I had gotten active with Lutheran Campus Ministry at Wisconsin, and then we were active there. And, of course, that's a whole nother story here with our university, with Lutheran Campus Ministry, because Wisconsin is the site of the birth of Lutheran Campus Ministry. You probably don't even know this, Bob.
And I don't know it.
In 2007, we will be celebrating our centennial. And
really?
Nationally, yes. And there are about 175 sites, and I'm on the National Centennial Committee, so I know all these details. But I began, of course, my church work has always been my avocation, since one of the things I had actually thought when I was at Trinity was actually going and working for the church in stewardship. Mm-hmm. or as a parish worker, going into social work, going, you know, doing that. But I ended up in higher ed, so I thought, which is my other love, so I thought I'll have my church work to be my avocation. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what I've always done, and been a volunteer in my church, and always done stewardship, and always done campus ministry as one of my volunteer activities. So I've done campus ministry at the local, state, and national levels. Mm. And so Madison, yeah, is the birthplace of Lutheran campus ministry.
Did not know that.
Yes. So for me, the West Virginia was a very active time in my life when both Gary and I, we were active in the married couple, and there was a great pastor there, Jerry Robbins, who was great. And Jerry Nockey was the pastor here at Madison at the time, here, and continued to be here when we moved back then.
And Martha, you all went to West Virginia when?
Well, it would be, let's see, 73 then through 75.
Okay.
Yeah. So I studied journalism, and I chose to do the thesis, because I wanted to do the thesis on educational fundraising and in higher ed. And again, I had thought about doing it on the church, but I decided to do it on higher ed. It's interesting. And I chose Wisconsin as one of the schools to study, and West Virginia was the other one. Hmm. Easy. But West Virginia was nice. One of the reasons they had this program was the...
This is tape 3, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 20th, 2006. So you're working on your thesis at West Virginia.
Right, right. I think compared Wisconsin and West Virginia, and then they sent me to my first case meeting, and then I, a professional organization, and that was really amazing, because that was the first time the American Alumni Association was a separate organization at that time. So all the alumni professionals, so it would be the Wisconsin Alumni Association group, they had their own organization. And then the people in development met separately in a development group, and they had just merged into a new group. I went to that first meeting. It was unbelievable. I was actually there. And that, so for that very, very first meeting. And that was kind of a shock to go to your first professional meeting when you're a student, you know, and you have to dress up and so on. And I'd never been to these things where you go to cocktail receptions. I mean, I didn't know that you actually drank. I mean, they drank and they did all these things, you know, and stuff. And, I mean, this was amazing to me. I was shocked. You actually had a good time at professional meetings, you know. I mean, I had no idea. And then I went to the first meeting of NOVA. Let's see if I can know what the acronym means. It's the something about the scholars studying philanthropy. Hmm. I'll remember it, but they were studying the field, and it's because I actually wrote and studied philanthropy. And I always kind of kept up and dabbled. I wasn't one to go to all those meetings and everything like others. But, you know, I went through the, you know, 2 seminars on development for a year, and I had to write a thesis in this. That, you know, you can do it. You know it's a subject. I mean, and I had to write about it before there were, I don't know, maybe there were 20 books on the subject. at the time. There were always like little pamphlets on it, but so that when, you know, 20 years later, when I saw the need with my friend Sandra Shaw, that there was a need for a women's philanthropy book, that I had no fear to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
That, and also because I had been through that process and I knew that it should and could be done. Because
mm-hmm.
I had always viewed development and philanthropy as an academic subject. And because I had been trained in it and academically. And it, you know, that's why I always encourage people to take, to go to one of these, you know, nonprofit, to get your, you know, master's in nonprofit management, or to take a seminar in it, because there's just nothing like studying a subject from an academic viewpoint. It mm-hmm. is different if you study it that way versus on-the-job training.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all know on-the-job training.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned something, a lot of things on-the-job training. And I wish I had taken different classes on them, you know, in my undergraduate days,
mm-hmm.
just to give you that fundamental understanding of, instead of like the details, how to, but just to give you that back up and give you that whole knowledge of things, you know, the background and the history and that kind of thing. Just that wider knowledge of a subject that you get when you take a class on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I always credit that education for writing the book. And I also credit my mom, because she's said, if you really want to make this subject important, you have to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
She told Sandra and me that. She said, it's fine, you're going around the country and giving speeches after we've done this for 2 years, but you're never going to establish this topic. You got to write a book.
Hmm.
So she said that.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we always credit her. But, and of course, the other person on that is my grandfather, because making up the field of women's philanthropy is, I knew you could just make up a field, because he had made up the field of chemical engineering, for heaven's sake. And, I mean, I would sit with him practically at his knee, and he would tell me stories. And later, as I grew up, at the table, at a kitchen table, or, you know, driving in the car, I mean, he would be telling stories about, you know, how he'd analyze things, and you know, how they made up the field of chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and why they needed to, and how you had to mold these two disciplines, and why it was important, and he'd laugh about it too. I mean, he would tell stories, and Sandra and I kind of laugh about different things that we made up too, about hypotheses,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And then we'd have hypotheses and test it when we'd do focus groups and stuff. But my grandfather always tells a story about how he went to a hydraulic plant in Norway, and he goes to talk to the manager of the plant, and he says, well, you know, how do you do such and such a process, and blah blah blah, and this process, and how is it that, you know, that this works? And he said, well, this is why it works. And he takes out my grandfather's book, and he says, what I did is this formula right here, and I applied it right here. Now he went, oh, you know, it's like, oh yes, of course. You know, you act like, oh yeah, like, of course this would work. I mean, it was purely theoretical. You know, my grandfather's work was, of course, purely theoretical.
Yes.
And, you know, the fact that, of course, that, you know, he applied it and the plant all worked. You know, it was like, and he just laughs about that story. You know, it was a wonderful story.
Well, and you must get that back when people say, well, you know, I read your book and I did,
yes.
and it worked.
And it works. Right. Because, of course, you know, we took our theories and we applied it in you know, two or three little experiments like my grandfather did. Mm-hmm. But then you hear about it, you know, in 150 places, and like the United Way of America has launched a women's philanthropy initiative in cities all over the whole country based on these theories. And it's like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. So it's great.
It's and it has to be thrilling for you, Mark.
It is. And lots of women and lots of men and lots of people have worked on it to fine-tune it over time. But it's the basic idea of putting those ideas that were floating out there, but organizing them and testing them and putting them in a logical form, you know. And that's what you have to do when you're writing a book. And that's what our faculty, what they do. And that's what my grandfather did. And that's what Sandra and I did. So, you know, and a lot of it I credit to, you know, going back to that process of writing the thesis, of looking at it, analyzing the field and looking at it for the first time. Mm-hmm. So it was a good exercise. It was a big pain in the neck, but it was a good exercise.
And we will return to this because we will be having a major segment later in the interview on the creation of the field of women and philanthropy. So we will return to this. Now, Martha, you and Gary must be getting close to coming back to Madison then.
Right, right.
And how does that happen?
Yeah, we both wanted to come back, and we both knew we wanted to come back. We just wanted this little hiatus away. And at that point, Gary had thought about going to law school either to come back, but he applied for law schools and was accepted to Madison. And so we came back, and in the summer, and my thesis wasn't quite printed yet, and so I was waiting. I got a part-time job at the YWCA doing publicity, waiting for my thesis to get printed, because I was thinking I was going to apply at the Alumni Association or different places around town, but I was waiting to apply to the foundation until my thesis got done.
Okay, so you had your sights set on the UW Foundation.
I did.
You knew you were going to make a case to be hired there.
Yes.
Okay.
I had hoped so. But I had no idea. And, of course, my grandfather and my grandmother knew Bob Rennebaum, and my mother had known him. She had known him from school, but not well. But he was very well respected and mm-hmm. a wonderful man. And my grandfather thought the world of him. One person, you know, Roland Day said, well, he's pretty conservative, but I thought, well, I don't know what that means. And, you know, conservative politically or just conservative as a person, I think conservative as a person, even if conservative politically, but beloved person, you know, and well thought of, you know, just, you know, my grandfather just said, oh, he's just a fine fellow, you know, just like that.
And how old was the foundation at this point?
Well, let's see, it was founded in 1955, so 20 years.
20 years. And when had Bob Rennebaum?
Or 45, 30 years, and he came in 1955.
Okay.
So he'd been there 20 years. He'd been there 20 years. It was formed in 1945, yeah.
Okay.
He'd been there 20 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because I was there 13 years when he was president. He was there for 33 years.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So what happened, Martha? How did
you
get hired?
So what happened is it was a Friday. I remember I got it in the mail. You know, I had to wait till it was printed. In those days, it took a while. And so I called up to get an interview, and I talked to him on the phone, and I said, I'm Martha Taylor, and I would like to have an interview. And I said, I'm Olaf Haugen's granddaughter, and I've had some classes in development, and I'm a Wisconsin graduate, and I'm interested in working at the foundation, and I hope you'd meet with me. And I figured, you know, just because of my grandfather, he would meet with me and Esther Haugen Taylor's daughter, because he knew them. But as I found out later, lots of people did that. I mean, lots of people tried to get jobs at the foundation who knew people. But, you see, I had actual, real development experience. I mean, interest. I had shown that I was really interested. It wasn't just a job. I actually had shown I was really, truly interested in the field. So I go in and I talk to Bob, and he must have liked me.
You had never met him before?
No. And, well, he obviously must have liked me. And, first of all, you know, I had my working at Trinity Lutheran Church in stewardship and in youth group and in historical society working with older people, doing the older people in the library. That's a good thing, working in development, because you're working with a lot of older people. You know, we had the... Oh, I did an oral history program. I forgot to mention that.
Did you?
Yeah, and I interviewed the a lot of the older people. I forgot to mention that. Huh. At Trinity Lutheran, and I taped them.
Well,
see? I went as part of that, the photos, and we got the tapes, and I interviewed some of the older people. Put them on tapes, and we had them at the church. Okay. So, you know, but that was good because that showed I was interested in older people. And then I had my experience of working at I worked at the West Virginia Foundation.
Oh, you did?
I did, as an intern. And then I'd gone to a case meeting. And then I had my thesis. And so I gave it to him. And... So I guess I showed that I was interested, you know. And then I had taken a lot of writing classes, and I had my references right there, and I gave it to him. And, you know, so he knew I was serious about that job. And I had people write to him. And then the other thing about it was that night there was some university event. I don't know. I think it was at the museum, at the Elvium then, Chazen now, where I saw my grandfather's. And he said, oh, my grandfather said, yeah, you saw Martha today. He said, yeah, and I'm almost done with her thesis. That was that night. And my grandfather said, oh, he's almost read your whole thing. He must have really read it, been interested. So we were very excited. So he was very interested that I had actually written this thing, you see. So the next week he calls me and he makes me an offer.
Really?
Yes.
Just based on the one interview?
On one interview, makes me an offer to come in, and he offers me $9,000, and I said, I've done my research, I said, oh, this is really thrilling, but do you, and he tells me what's for the faculty relations, and then the President's Club. And I said, oh, that would be terrific. It's just perfect. Oh, and I had said I had wanted to work in the President's Club area. That I had thought that would be a good area for me. Working to get new members and on
was that the predecessor of the
Baskin Hill Society.
Okay.
I had said in the interview, well, what do you want to work on? I thought that would be a good area to work on. And, you know, and then he offered me $9,000, and I said, oh, that is so wonderful. I said, but, you know, I was really hoping for 10 because that's the beginning salary of teachers. He said, okay, you got it. It's the only time, of course, that's my only job interview that I've ever negotiated. But I had done my homework on finding teachers' salary, beginning teacher salary. So I began at the foundation in October 15th, 1975.
So... 30 years you've been there. 31, actually.
31. Unbelievable.
So, Martha, you're at the foundation. This is the second half of the 70s.
What were those early years for you in your career like? And with whom were you working?
Okay. First, I think it would be good to say the percentage of state support for the university was 49%. Mm-hmm. And today, in 2006, it's 16%. I mean, that's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really horrible when you think about it. So it's 49%. So the foundation, we were kind of viewed as icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That was really more our role. And you also have to look at over time, and that's what I think somebody has to do a really good statistical analysis of cost per dollar per staff raised when you look at the statistics of the dollar amount raised over time by the foundation staff. Because now we have a lot of staff and we raise a lot of money. But then we had 9 people in 1975.
Hmm.
And for 9 people, we raised an awful lot of money. And we were the frosting on the cake. And so the role of the foundation in 1975 was really to look at the areas of the university that are truly the margin of excellence. And I know that in our vision statement for the foundation, we still say that, but we are a lot more than the margin of excellence now. We are truly looking at core responsibilities and a lot more than just, we're not the frosting on the cake. We're more, you know, a partnership. You know, we have all these sayings, you know, the public-private partnership with the state. But the relationship has changed. And we hope that the state support is going to go up. And we, you know, the whole dynamics have changed. But in 75, what we were looking at, a lot of what we funded was really wonderful things, added things, and a lot of them were in the arts. So the then Alvium Museum was a big area that we concentrated on.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the director of the Alvium now, Russell Pensenko, and I, we were talking about that, about how in the beginning days of the museum, the foundation, that was one of our primary focuses, is the museum.
Hmm.
And that, because it was one of our biggest campaigns, was to raise the money for the museum. And I kind of came in at the tail end of that, when the museum had been completed, and we were celebrating that, and having a lot of things at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And we also did things with music. Dale Gilbert, who was then the chairman of music, was over there quite a bit at the foundation visiting Bob, and we'd be raising money for the marching band or for Bob Fountain's tours in the spring for the concert choir or for the Pro Arti Quartet for different things.
Mm-hmm.
So the arts were an area the foundation worked on.
Hmm.
We also worked on things. We started, our first professorship was Irv Meyer's, for Irv Meyer, journalism. Actually, I think he was a business grad, but he was in journalism for the Milwaukee Journal Company. He was chair of the Milwaukee Journal Company, and
right.
a wonderful chair of the foundation board, and actually chair of the President's Club. And that was the first professorship of the foundation, and actually the Olaf Haugen professorship was the first named professor for a professor.
Is that right, Martha? I did not know that.
Yes, it was my grandfather. Yes.
Did you work on that, or was that before your time?
Before my time. And yes, so that's that is a very nice thing. Yes, it was really founded by students of his. And it really had been Bob Bird and some of the other faculty in the chemical engineering department had said, when this one alumnus had said, what would really be good for the Department of Professorship in name for Olaf Hagenmüller? And the donor said, oh, that's the best idea. And so that's what happened. And then they did a little campaign to raise additional dollars because they thought as an opportunity to raise more money, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was very shy about this whole thing. But they did, you know, do that. And so that's why we have the Olaf Hagenmüller Professorship.
So nice for you.
It is. Isn't that nice?
It is very nice.
It is nice.
For the university, but for you and your mother as well.
It is nice. It was very nice of his students and the faculty to want to do this, and Bob Bird. And that professorship was wonderful. It's to bring in visitors, of course, outside the faculty. So I've met all these professors over the years. And
I was going to ask if you stayed in touch with them.
Yeah, I've stayed in touch with the department very closely over the years and know the faculty, and they're like a second family. So they're wonderful. And that department just celebrated its centennial last year, and we had a wonderful celebration. And I actually got to speak at the dinner.
I was going to ask, Martha, did you get to speak?
I got to speak at the dinner. I was so pleased, and I think they were pleased, and they knew I spoke at foundation events, but I don't think they realized what a good speaker I was. And I mean, they knew, but I mean, the engineers all came up, and how could they not have liked my speech? Because what I did is I just went up and talked about my grandfather, but then I talked about how he had been, you know, my mentor and really my major professor, just as he had been for many of them, and how many professors in the department are like him today, and many were like him then, and that there was this cadre that created this environment, which is true in that department, which made it. It was not only their research and teaching, but it was the fundamental personalities of the professors that were so grounded in being so good to each other and respectful of each other. And they made the environment so good that people really soared, you know, and did so well academically.
Mm-hmm.
And that goodwill was seen because for one little department, chemical engineering, which is like they have, 17 faculty members? The alumni for the centennial filled Great Hall. One little department.
Wow.
And, you know, people came from Japan and things. And then I said, I mean, I was the closing speaker, but then I talked about why I felt and what I learned from chemical engineers and why chemical engineering is so important to the world.
How wonderful.
And it is. It is. And what my grandfather taught me about chemical engineering and about how, and I've always used that of, and why I've always felt, for example, in my leadership at the university club, and that my grandfather always said this too, and I'm going into this because this is university history, so it's important for oral history, but why, when we're so isolated in our departments and we don't go to the university club for lunch like we used to as faculty members,
right. That
knowledge gets in our silos, which David Ward used to say.
Mm-hmm.
But if more faculty would go and have lunch, interdisciplinary and interdepartment, between different departments, that knowledge would explode more, you know, because you would have people discussing things across discipline. And then you would have more information going across, and you would learn, and things apply to different areas. That's why I don't like the idea of people saying, certain people we both know saying, you can only go to a conference that's very specialized mm-hmm. in your particular area. You need to go to broad conferences or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, like, our new Institute for Discovery is so important. It's going to have all these departments in it. Mm-hmm. Well, chemical engineering is like that because it takes these two disciplines and it merges them. And it's the idea of taking different disciplines and learning from each other. And I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I told him. And it's always good to feel that your field is acknowledged and your mind is acknowledged. But chemical engineers and are probably one of our most brilliant group of alumni who graduate from this university. I mean,
is that right, Martha?
You had to be extremely smart to be in chemical engineering. Like, really smart. And, of course, their undergrad, they're our top. They get the top money going out here.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, that it's, yeah. But they're, because they have to combine these different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So the Olaf Hagen professorship was the first named professorship?
Mm-hmm.
Named for a professor
named
here.
Named for a professor. Yeah, oh. And Erwin Meyer was the first one. But see, look at that. Think of that. There was only two when I got there. I mean, and then we had
that
memorial
is amazing.
Funds. I mean, it's amazing. Then we had memorial funds. Okay, and that was like faculty relations. So what did I do half-time faculty relations? I set up memorial funds for faculty. And then if faculty wanted to do small little fund drives for like anniversary funds with
uh-huh.
the departments, I would do, because I had, you know, my journalism degree and stuff, I do their little direct mails and things and work with them on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd work with setting up the funds with John Felt and who answered all the department inquiries themselves. I mean, there was only five people. Let's see, who were they? Ted Zillman, who did planned gifts. He was the former dean of men. Of course, Bob Rannenbaum, who was my mentor and carried me through. Fred Winding, who did annual giving and worked with people on some different real estate gifts. Then John Felt, who did all of the investments and, like, the different funds, all of the books.
Hmm.
And me. That was the professional staff.
That was it?
That's it. That's it. Then we had four secretaries, and we had one records person, Bonnie Schumacher.
Oh, was Bonnie back there then?
Mm-hmm. Bonnie had been there for 4 years before me, and she went, she's about the same age as
this is side 2, tape 3, Martha Taylor.
Yeah, Bonnie had her... Bonnie was basically the first 10, 15 years. I was there maybe 10. Yeah, is a clerical worker, keep punching the gifts in.
Hmm.
And when she was busy, because she had, you know, Jeff, her boy, she was raising on her own. And, you know, that's a big responsibility,
mm-hmm.
raising a boy all by yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
single parent back then wasn't all that common.
No, not at all. It's amazing. She worked full time. I just can't believe she did all that by herself.
Hmm.
It's amazing. So she, you know, she couldn't go to all the conferences and things I was going to. But I was on, at that point, I was on a different track. I mean, she's still not interested in the kind of things she's interested in administration. But So I was on the professional track, but let's talk a little bit about that on the right now. This was a very strange environment I walked into, because here I had these men and me. And so I was a little aware of, I had been talking a little bit about, you know, feminism, and of course I had, we had been going through, at that time, you know, there was issues of feminism and that kind of thing. And I had decided to go back and use Martha Taylor, even though legally I was Martha Antonowitz. I had decided to use Martha Taylor because it was just much easier to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I applied for the job. That's the name that was on my thesis and everything, because it was just, and also being in journalism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I thought, I'm my own person. Gary was kind of like, oh, you want to do that? Oh, I guess it's okay. All right, whatever. And he went, oh, well, you know. And, you know, it's fine, mm-hmm. whatever. And, but it was kind of like the first day I was there. And then the first week. Because I got there, I think we were supposed to start like at 8:15 or something. I go to my office. All the men disappeared at 9:00 in the morning. Oh, and then all the secretaries leave at 9:30. And I said, well. And then one of them pokes their head in, do you want to go to coffee with us? And I said, what's this? And they said, well, there's something about a mandatory break legally that the secretaries have to have or something, you know, to take a coffee break or some kind of a break. So they go downstairs and have a coffee break. So, but the men go at 9:00. Well, so... This goes on for, and of course, I'm sitting there with the secretaries. This is four secretaries, including Bonnie Schumacher. Three secretaries, Bonnie Schumacher and me. And of course, I'm talking to Ruthie, who's Bob and Mom's secretary, and I'm saying, well, what about this for the annual fund, or doing this? And she says, oh, you should talk to Fred about that. You should talk. And I'm going, and they're all talking about their recipes and whatever, and I don't cook, so I'm not interested in this. And I'm thinking, uh-oh. So then I get something in the mail. It was like right away. And it was from the sales and marketing executives of Madison. And it was on women's communications or women executives or something. And I went to it. It was like right away. It was like, really, within the first month I'd been there, or even sooner. I mean, very shortly. And I went there, and Gail Langer was there. She was a member of the Gail of the Sales, and I met her for the first time. And then I heard, you know, at that session, and they were talking about all these informal ways that you are discriminated against as a woman. And I just, you know, it just hit me in the face that there it was, right there, the coffee hour, or half hour. There it was, because in that whatever 3 weeks that I'd been, there were no staff meetings.
Uh-huh.
There were no staff meetings, Bob, no staff meetings. All of the business was taking place at the coffee hour.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been totally isolated. I never would have made it at the foundation, ever. Okay. So what did I do? I remember this was on a Friday. The next Monday, Ted Zillman, he was a sweet man. He had the office next to me. I said, I was so scared. I said, Ted, this is about quarter. Ted, do you mind if I come to coffee with you this morning? because I knew if I asked the other guys, Fred or John, they would really look at me dirty, because they always like to tell the dirty jokes already.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, Fred was always flirting with everybody, and you know, he would really not like it.
No.
And they would really not like it. Bob would have been fine. He would have been just fine. And he was, always. And, but Fred and John, no. And, Ted said, of course, we just didn't think you would like to go. I said, I'd like to. I didn't say why. And from then on, I went to coffee with him every single day. Every single day for 5 years. And Tim Riley came 3 months in after Ted retired. And Tim was hired. And Tim came. And, of course, Tim and I worked well together because we were the newcomers, you know. And, but I always, Bob and I talked about a lot of stuff, but I would always hold all my agenda items that I'd bring up just casually. And that's when I first had to start to learn about sports. I had to read because I knew nothing about sports.
Having been athletic yourself in high school, you said.
Yeah, I had, but being
knowledgeable
swimming
about football
and knowing anything about football and yeah, is very different. Keeping up with the you know, the coaches and the games and all this stuff but then it got to be kind of fun, you know, and then of course I had two boys who were very athletic, and then it actually got real fun, and you know, then they got me, my boys got me football for dummies and basketball coach for dummies. And of course this last year when my youngest son wasn't on the varsity team at Memorial, he got cut the senior year, because they're made state, you know, they got all these people transferring in the district to vie for the team, so some of the other kids that got cut and these other football players put his team together in the rec league, and they wanted a really cool coach. They asked me to coach it. So I was a basketball coach. So you never know, Bob, what's going to happen to your life.
Martha, now you've been invited at your own instigation to join the informal power structure of the foundation. I wish you would talk about it a bit, because I would think that would have been a challenge and, in fact, difficult.
Yeah. I think it was very, very, very difficult. And it was psychologically mind-boggling at times. It was a different day and age. I think that's the way to look at it. Bob was always the one to encourage me. You know, he really encouraged me. And of course, one of the reasons he did, he had a good relationship, a wonderful relationship with Jean, his wife. And he had two wonderful daughters that he always encouraged. And, you know, I always knew that. And of course, Bob also, we had the same church background too. So I always knew he had the church background where women are equals in the Lutheran church. You know, women are equals. There's not any, you know, women are behind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you know that about somebody. And, but yet, there were definite issues that I had to deal with, you know, professionally. Where are you professionally? But, Fred and John, it was very, very difficult being respected as a woman professional. And especially, I think, one that is creative and wants to go on and do something outside of the boundaries, you know, and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
I think with John felt... he always said no to things, both to Tim Riley and me, because he was being in his role as accountant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always used to think, well, maybe he's just holding back. No, he used to do it to Tim, too. He was always worried about expenses and that kind of thing. And that's just kind of his role,
mm-hmm.
you know, as the accountant type.
Mm-hmm.
But they were always, I think if it were up to Fred and John, in a way, they would have had us be a tiny, tiny shop, and they would have not had it expand like we did.
I see. Oh, interesting.
And yet John wanted us to expand because he wanted us to have more money. And, you know, so it was very odd to me. So I never understood. I mean, John is very, very happy with the foundation now and the way that it expanded money. But he always fought expansion and spending money for development.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it was his, just his duty that he felt of, as an accountant, as I said, but me as a woman in particular, I just felt like, you know, they were just bucking me all the time.
So any idea that you had that you might bring up was rejected or criticized?
Yeah. Well, no, it wasn't so much the. It wasn't so much the ideas as just sometimes it was ideas. Not just the way they joked around all the time, I guess. The way I was treated professionally in the office.
Oh, I see.
More like that. And it wasn't more the actual what we did. Do. And Fred, in fact, because I think it was also Tim and I were more ambitious. And we wanted the foundation to really expand more. We really did. We wanted to expand. And that's why Bob hired us. And Bob encouraged us. And Bob promoted both of us and gave us a lot of responsibility. You know, so there was a real strain there.
Uh-huh.
A real strain.
So Bob was moving beyond the limit, as he might have enjoyed John Felt and Fred Winding personally,
right.
But
yes.
He had a larger vision than they
Bob
did.
Bob had a larger vision.
Okay.
He really felt it needed to expand.
Okay.
It really needed to expand. But on the other hand, Bob wasn't one to he hated to have any kind of dissension and disagreement, and so he wasn't good on managing disagreements.
Oh.
It was his real big weakness.
So John and Fred could have been, in a way, a bit of a bully to you and maybe Tim.
Yeah, or, well, he depended too much on informal communication for things, where he needed, sometimes I think it would have been good to have a formal staff meeting. And then me later, as I rose, when Bob would depend on me for saying, Bob, I think you need to have a meeting on these issues, as we got bigger and bigger, you know, he would have a meeting, but he would never be able to kind of get at the issues and,
mm-hmm.
And really, that gets into, I think, later some of the issues that were unsettling for Bob, as you know, because Bob was really a lover and not a fighter.
Oh,
uh-huh.
That's very interesting.
Yeah,
Martha.
Yeah,
that's a very useful comment.
Yeah. So it was hard for him when people disagreed about things.
Uh-huh.
But I think there were, you know, I think you had Fred always flirting with everyone, and you know, you had to cut him off all the time. And but you know, once he understood where he stood, it was, then it was fine. He just went on. He just kind of harmless. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that was the kind of atmosphere in the old days, and play, you know, he just goofed around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, even then.
Oh yeah.
He was never a particularly productive fundraiser.
No.
Okay.
No.
But he was there for a long time.
He was. He was. But he knew a lot of people, and you know, he had potential, and sometimes he'd get out and he'd be charming when he would get out. Mm-hmm. Talk to people. But I don't know if he just never had the oomph.
Uh-huh. So, and you do have the oomph. I mean, you would get out there.
Yeah,
so that
Tim did. John worked very, very hard, of course.
So that would have upset the equilibrium a little bit, I assume.
That did. It did for Fred, I think, because both Tim and I worked very, very hard. And also we started to, you know, look at the performance of different things in the office and, you know, that kind of thing.
And when did Tim Riley join?
3 months after I started.
Oh, so you both go back.
Yeah, we go back a long way. So in the beginning, really, Tim and I worked really well, really, really well together. I think when we started adding staff, things got more complicated. But in that, Tim wanted to keep all the best prospects for himself, and that was too bad for the new people coming on.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
But Sandy did change that by, you know, allowing everyone to have access to every alumnus, you know, and that was a wonderful contribution that Sandy made.
And this is Sandy Wilcox.
Sandy Wilcox, yes, when he came. Because that needed to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you see, it was that, that was the only, you know, kind of problem. But, you know, you have growing pains like that.
Mm-hmm.
But so far as looking at, I guess we have time on the discrimination issue, I do want to share that there were particular issues that that happened that one in particular that when Gary got out of law school and I was asked to I was asking to put him on my health insurance and I just went into John's office one day, and I said, "John, Gary's graduating, you know, and I want to give him the family health insurance. How much does that cost per month? You know, because I thought we all had to pay for that. So then he says, "Oh, I'll get back to you." So then he gets back to me, and he was trying to, I think John, in hindsight, was trying to leak me information. Because John knew what they were doing wasn't right. But he said something like, the bottom line is this, is that, well, it's about $150 a month, but I'm not sure exactly, because some people in the office don't have to pay that for family health insurance.
Really?
Yeah. I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, you just get back to me on that. And so then what I did is, so John was really trying to leak it to me, I do have to say. But this went on for 6 weeks. And so I went around and I talked to everybody, different people individually. I found out Dave Spengler, who was the athletic fundraiser, was getting health and family health insurance paid for. The bottom line was all the men were getting family health insurance paid for and all the women were not.
Really?
Yes. Including Bonnie Schumacher, who had been raising this boy. And
she was having to pay?
No, she put her son on her husband. But it wasn't as good as health insurance. And she had said to me, yes, it's too bad I have to put him on whatever ex-husband's name because the health insurance isn't as good. I didn't say anything. And then this other woman who was Fred's secretary, her husband owned his own business. And they had to buy extra. Okay. And they were, not rich. Okay. So I just get this little information. So I went home to my lawyer husband, and Gary said, this is illegal. So I thought, what do I do? I went and talked to Ed Young, and I said, Ed, what do I do? Blah, blah, blah. My friend Ed Young, who is the former chancellor and president mm-hmm. of the university. I had been very close to Ed, and I haven't talked about that yet, but a wonderful man. And just, he had been my mother's, very close to my mother when she was getting her economics degree. Way back. And so I always felt Ed was a good friend, and I had worked with him and done a lot of projects with him. So I went to Ed, and I said, well, first go and talk to Helen Madsen at the legal office, and then you really should just go talk to Bob. Okay. And so I went and talked to Helen Madsen on a confidential basis and talked to her just to make sure it was illegal, and yes, it was. Okay. So then one day I got my guts up and I went in and I said, I closed the door because Bob always had an open door. And I closed the door and I sat down and I said, Bob, I really have to talk to you about this. And I told him about the health insurance. And he said, well, your husband really should be responsible for you to pay for this.
Really?
Yes. But you see, that was the prevalent idea. And that's what a lot of the board members also had about. They really didn't have that about my salary because they gave me good salaries. They always gave me good salaries, very good salaries. But still, that was out there. And it's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's still out there. So, I said, yeah, that may be so, but he's starting his law practice, and, I want to put him on my health insurance. And I need to be able to do that as a professional, just everybody in the office. Anyone who wants to go on family coverage can. And Bob, if you offer it to one person, you have to offer it to everybody. That's the law. And I said, Bob, I want to just tell you a story. And I'd read about this story about the guy who had been the head of, responsible for the Dane County Airport. Luckily, I just read about this. And he had, unfortunately, had to resign recently because of a discrimination suit against him. And I said, that's not going to happen to you, Bob, because I am not going to sue you, and I'm not going to sue the foundation. But somebody is.
You're good, Martha.
And I said, somebody is, Bob. And I said, Bob, this is not right, and it's not fair, and you need to do the right thing. And then I left his office, and everybody in the office got family health insurance.
Really?
So yep.
He did to change it.
He did the right thing, because Bob was a fair and just individual, and I knew he would respond like that.
Did he ever speak to you about it?
No, he didn't have to. He didn't have to.
Martha, it's so interesting, isn't it, about John Felt mm-hmm. giving you that little
yeah.
nudge. That opened the door for you.
It opened the door for me. Yeah. But I always think, couldn't John Felt have done more with Bob? You know, at that time I was really mad with with John saying, John, you're the financial officer. Why aren't you advocating this with Bob?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But he gave me the information, you see. So.
But don't you think that's how history is?
It was all right.
You know,
somebody
mm-hmm. who knows but can't will give the knowledge
to
the one who can.
But he gave me the information.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
it's just interesting.
It was. It was a very key thing because he didn't have to say that. He could have said it's $150. But he said, but some people in this office have family health insurance. So it was resolved, and and Bonnie got her coverage and put Jeff on it, and this other young person got it. And, you know, again, I always thought, if I ever did anything, that's what I did. And so, you know, you got to be there, and you got to do your thing. And I've done other things related to women's issues and diversity issues at the foundation over time. And, you know, you just kind of have to be quiet and shut up and not be screaming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do speak up, and I'm making enough noise about different things. But the bottom line is you have to save the times when you really do things.
And Martha, do you think the issue of discrimination against professional women at the foundation and elsewhere has continued to this day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. It's certainly not as bad as it was. Certainly not as bad.
But you made earlier reference to that, you know, when you said, and it still continues. And I believe that it does.
Yes.
I just wanted to have you comment on that.
Yes, and I think still today it definitely is at the foundation and is at other places, and but it will get better, and we just have to work to make it so.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have been. And again, I'm anticipating what you will be saying later. Really a fearless advocate for women.
Yes.
Professional women. At the foundation and nationally.
Yeah, I really have.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working on that a long time. Sometimes I think I'm a broken record on it, but...
this concludes side two of tape 3.